It's Morning Edition from NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley, and it's time for the New Hampshire News Recap. We're now about a month out from the September 8th state primary. In the first congressional district, there are crowded fields jockeying for both the Democratic and Republican nominations, but polls show about half of voters in each party still remain undecided. NHPR's Todd Bookman files this story from the Democratic trail on what candidates are offering and what voters may be looking for.
There are a few possible reasons why so many voters are still undecided. For starters, it's the height of summer. Except for political diehards, people aren't really paying attention yet. Totally normal. A second reason, there's just a lot of candidates to choose from. Seven on the Democratic side alone.
You know, I think people are looking for change. I haven't heard one person in 15 months saying, like, things are going great. And, like, we should just keep going, right? And look, our campaign represents that change. Our campaign represents that new generation of leadership that is going to.
I talked with voters at a recent House party for Maura Sullivan in Manchester. Sullivan ran for this same seat in 2018, losing to Chris Pappas in the first district primary. She's a Marine, Iraq War veteran, and so far, the race's top fundraiser. In the crowd, Joshua Blanchard is listening while holding a squirmy 8-month-old baby. He works at a lumberyard and is one of those still undecideds. He's got a lot on his mind.
Affordability is probably number one. We've seen costs go up exponentially, especially adding members of the family. And, it's been tough to just make the everyday ends meet. And I don't think I've seen the Democrats, and definitely not the Republicans, actually speak to that in a way that has answers.
Another voter, Ann Williams from Manchester, stood nearby in the crowded living room. She said, like a lot of Democrats, she's not exactly optimistic about much these days. And she gets why some younger Dems, nationally, are getting behind far-left progressives.
And they are very hungry for radical change. As an older person, I feel like, yes, we need change, but it's going to have to come through moderate steps. We can't flip a switch. We're not New York City.
Certainly not, no. What flies in Brooklyn may not fly in Portsmouth.
Well, thanks, everybody. Can you all hear me from here? Does that work?
I caught up with voters at a Stephanie Shaheen event in a lovely backyard. She's a former city councilor here and daughter of Senator Gene Shaheen. Her stump speech this night is heavy on health care and what she sees as corruption by the Trump administration. But she also talks up affordability in big, sweeping terms.
The next generation doesn't feel that the promise of this country is in reach because they're trying to figure out how to get out of their parents' basement, how to keep their health care, how to afford rent, how to pay their student loan debt. That's what's at stake in this election.
During the Q&A, a guy named Peter Cass asks where the policy differences are between Shaheen and Sullivan. It's a good question, one I suspect a lot of undecided voters may be asking themselves. For Cass, there's no obvious answer, and it's holding him back from making up his mind.
So I really don't know, and I probably won't know until I get in the voting booth. I really don't know.
The clock is ticking. People are going to have to make up their minds soon. And in a way, that's fuel for all the candidates, the chance to surge late. On the same night as the Shaheen House party, another candidate, Christian Arudia, is across town working another Portsmouth backyard. That's where I meet Stephanie Willette from Exeter.
Hi.
Hi.
In a way, she's representative of a lot of Democrats. She's been a keyboard warrior, firing off social media posts against the Trump administration. And now is starting to get directly involved in political campaigns. In Arudia, she's found her apparent dream candidate.
He's got the goods, obviously. Smart, a lawyer, military man.
Arudia is in the National Guard and previously was an executive for Airbnb. His politics run to the left of Sullivan and Shaheen's. He's chasing more progressive voters.
You got to dismantle ICE. You got to dismantle it. No one's going to save ICE, all right? We're not going to go there and be like, hey, you guys got it kind of wrong. Like, be better now. Like, this has been completely corrupted by this administration. So what do we need to do? One, dismantle it. Two, replace it with something that's consistent with our values.
Values, policies, experience, that may all factor into how up-in-the-air voters finally decide this primary. Last Saturday, Rochester held its annual Pride celebration, and more than half the field of CD1 Dems showed up to work the scene.
I'm running on principles.
Sarah Chedzinski is a nonprofit executive who's also in the primary.
Listen, we're a hunting, Harley-riding, Democratic family here that loves having our kids grow up here with bare feet out in the community here in New Hampshire.
Hampton Select Board Chair Carly Berriant seems at ease meeting with Pride revelers and just campaigning in general.
I mean, this is amazing. Like, I get to go around and spend an entire year listening to the things that are keeping people up at night and driving them crazy, and then asking them if they want to help me be in a position to do something about it. And that possibility and how many people are so fired up right now is absolutely keeping me going.
And then there's Heath Howard, a 26-year-old state rep backed by the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists.
I mean, money is not necessarily the end-all be-all in elections this cycle, and people are very clearly looking for something different and not status quo, which the other candidates that are throwing money at this race can't provide.
In this crowded race, each brings something different, yeah. They just now need to convince voters they're the best choice on the ballot. Todd Bookman, NHPR News.
This is the New Hampshire News Recap. I'm Rick Gamley. A hearing in federal court in Concord this week put the spotlight on how police are dealing with growing numbers of individuals who are unhoused in the state. Shruti Gopalakrishnan, Concord Monitor reporter, has been reporting on the hearing. Welcome, Shruti.
Hi, Rick.
This is a class action lawsuit on behalf of Robert Clark, a formerly unhoused person in Concord, and it centers on how police have been using the state's loitering law, right?
Yes. So Robert Clark was unhoused in Concord for about 13 years, and according to the lawsuit, he's had several encounters with Concord police over that time, and he was arrested twice under the state's loitering law. And one of those incidents happened when Clark was in a parking garage just trying to keep warm, and police saw him smoking from a piece of tinfoil, and they suspected it was fentanyl. But he wasn't arrested for drug possession. He was instead arrested under the state's loitering law, and that's really what this lawsuit is based on, the claim that people experiencing homelessness are being targeted through the use of this law.
I think we should probably explain, what is the loitering law exactly?
Yeah, so the law states that a person commits a violation if they knowingly appear at a place or at a time under the circumstances that warrant alarm for the safety of persons or property in the area. And basically, it's intended to let police intervene when someone's behavior suggests there may be a threat to public safety.
And what's the lawsuit's objection?
So the ACLU represents Clark here, and their argument is that a law that was originally intended to address prowlers is instead being used to criminalize homelessness. They're also making other arguments, one that the law is unconstitutionally vague, and the other that it violates the 4th and 14th Amendments by allowing unreasonable searches and seizures. But their broader point seems to be that the way the law is written, they feel that it could sweep in everyday harmless behavior, even when someone has no intention of committing a crime at all.
And does this center kind of around that phrase warrant alarm in the statute? I mean, that seems to be open to interpretation.
Yes, it definitely does seem to be open to interpretation. And that became one of the central issues during Monday's hearing in federal court. The judge asked the state's attorney how the state interprets the phrase warrant alarm. And Sam Gagne, the attorney representing the state, said the state basically views it equal into reasonable suspicion. But the judge didn't really seem happy with that answer and said that interpretation could create a Fourth Amendment problem because police can only make an arrest based on probable cause, which is a higher legal standard than reasonable suspicion.
And how else is the state responding to this?
The state says the law serves a legitimate purpose. They say police are just simply doing their jobs, responding to complaints about public safety. But in Clark's case specifically, the state argues that he wasn't arrested because he was homeless. Instead, they say officers responded because of the conduct they believed warranted concern for public safety. And under those circumstances, they felt that the action by the police was right.
I don't know when we'll see a ruling on this, but what are the implications of this case?
If the judge finds that the law is unconstitutionally vague or that it allows arrest without sufficient legal justification, that could change how police departments across New Hampshire enforce the state's loitering law. And the ACLU is also trying to expand the case by making it a class action.
And by class action lawsuit, what do you mean?
So, yeah, right now, Robert Clark is the plaintiff in this case, and the ACLU wants to explain this to make it a class action. So anyone who in the future is affected by this law or how police enforce this could be protected depending on how the judge rules on this case.
And do we know if others are planning to join that?
No, we don't have any knowledge of that yet.
Shruti Gopalakrishnan is a Concord Monitor reporter. Shruti, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you for having me.
This is the New Hampshire News Recap from NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley. It's time to turn our eyes to the skies. The Perseid meteor shower reaches its annual peak during the month of August. And St. Anselm College astronomy professor Nicole Gallucci is here to chat with us about how to best see the celestial show. Welcome, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Nicole, can we explain basically what a meteor shower is and why Perseids are so big?
Yeah, a meteor shower happens when the Earth plows through a bit of space debris. This debris could be little dust particles or little rocks, things that burn up in the Earth's atmosphere. And so we see them as what we call a shooting star, and it's not really a star. The Perseids are created by debris left by a comet called Swift-Tuttle. So once a year, the Earth goes through this particular debris cloud, and we see a pretty sharp increase over the course of about a week or so. But there's a couple nights in particular where it's at its peak, and we see a lot.
What makes it a real shower? I mean, how many will we possibly see?
Yeah, the shower can get up to 90 meteors per hour. That's a little more than 1 minute. You get this great number of meteors. But also, one of the reasons I think the Perseids is particularly popular is the time of year. August evenings, after it's been super hot, you're outside late at night where it's cooled down, but it's not super cold like it is for some meteor showers that are in the winter. I think it's just a nicer time for folks to be out and be able to see it.
And what makes this particular year good for the Perseids? Is it the fact that we're going to have a new moon?
Exactly it. Yeah, the moon, as beautiful as it is, causes a lot of stray light through the sky, so you can't see fainter objects. Because the shower is lining up with the period of the new moon, which means the moon is not visible in the night sky, that means that the sky is going to be as dark as possible, particularly if you get away from city light.
What are some other tips for the best way for us to go and see these?
Get yourself a nice, comfortable chair you can lean back in, and give yourself a chance to get your eyes to get dark adapted, meaning it'll take between 10 minutes and half an hour for you to really be able to see faint objects, and just kind of keep your eyes watching as much of the sky as possible. You really want to keep yourself with as wide a field of view as possible, and you're going to start to catch them.
Nicole, is there actually a way to hear meteors?
Using just a simple AM radio, if you tune it between stations or to, you know, a station that's just a little too distant for you to pick up, when the meteors come through, it'll boost the signal a little bit, and so you can kind of hear that contribution. Another way you can view the meteors is there's going to be a bunch of organizations doing live streams. They'll have full sky cameras that you can watch, too.
Nicole, ever make a wish on a shooting star?
Maybe for grant funding.
Astronomy professor Nicole Gallucci from the St. Anselm College. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the time, and happy meteor hunting.
Thank you. Same to you.
If you want to hear more about celestial happenings, tune into Cosmically Curious every Sunday morning and every Monday morning right here on NHPR. That's it for this week's New Hampshire News Recap. But if you missed part of today's segment or if you want to catch up on previous weeks, you can find the New Hampshire News Recap wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR.